Now to the emerging use of psychedelic drugs in mental health treatments. In July of 2023, the Therapeutic Goods Administration in Australia introduced new rules to make it possible for authorised psychiatrists to prescribe psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression and MDMA for PTSD. This week, the journal Nature Medicine published a new study about the effects of another psychedelic drug, dimethyltryptamine, or DMT for short. Dr. David Erizo is a psychiatrist and neuroscientist and clinical associate professor at Imperial College London. He was the chief investigator on this study, and I'm very pleased to say that he joins us on Sunday Extra now. Welcome, David.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
So, David, what is DMT and how does it differ from other psychedelic drugs?
Yeah, so the two that you mentioned that you in Australia have stepped forward and allowed in controlled way clinical use of DMT is similar to psilocybin. It's much more similar than to MDMA. We call them classic serotonergic psychedelics, both DMT and psilocybin. They're quite similar in structure to the brain signal molecule called serotonin itself. So they work a bit similarly. The difference is that DMT, if you just take it through the mouth, it gets broken down before it becomes active in the brain. So we used it into the vein intravenously in this trial, over 10-minute infusion into the vein, whereas psilocybin, for instance, is typically given orally. That also informs something quite important of difference, and that is that a psilocybin session, a bit similar to MDMA sessions, they are 4 or 5 hours long. A DMT session, as we trialed here, was only 25-30 minutes, because after a 10-minute infusion, the DMT is quite brief, the experience. And you can see that that's in itself a reason to test how does the antidepressant effect of DMT compare to psilocybin, because if it's more like a 25-30 minute session rather than a 4-hour, 5-hour session, then you can potentially be able in a clinic or in hospitals to treat more people in a day. And it's important where the money are limited in public health treatment systems.
Where does DMT come from, and is it used in other ways as well as the exploratory use for medical purposes?
Yeah, that's very, very important to mention that it has a very rich history, humans use centuries, maybe millennia of use. And the main use has been in this Amazonian psychedelic brew called ayahuasca. There are different versions of these brews, and they have been used in shamanistic ceremonial contexts. And that means there's a great experience with DMT. However, when it's used in that context, then it comes not from a lab, it's not synthesized, it comes a part of a plant element, and then it's mixed with some other plant elements that contain other molecules. And when they are mixed in the brew of ayahuasca or equivalents, then it becomes active through the mouth. I just said DMT in its own is not, but when mixed with some other compounds that prevent it from being broken down in the gut, then it becomes orally active. And then it's more, again, a 4 or 5 hour experience after that, drinking that brew. So that's in a way the same psychedelic active molecule, DMT, but certainly a longer experience and in a different way through a brew.
Really interesting. On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Dr. David Erizo about this new study into the effects of DMT on people with treatment-resistant depression. So, David, run us through what the trial was and what you observed in it.
Yeah, so the term treatment resistant is a bit of a tricky term. Also, it sounds like, oh, you can't be treated because you're resistant to treatment. So it's more like a hard-to-treat kind of concept, and you can define that in different ways. In this study, people needed to have tried 2 different kinds of treatments before, and they were randomly allocated to 1 of 2 treatment conditions. Either they got the same preparation, but instead of getting the drug, they got a placebo, and the same support, music, room, integration after, or in the other condition, they got the same thing, but with the active DMT. There were 34 to begin with, so then 17 in each group, and then 2 weeks follow-up. And in that period, everybody was as blinded as possible to the condition, meaning that it was not revealed what they were given and so on. And then after 2 weeks, it becomes what's called open label. You are now offered the opportunity to get a DMT experience either for the first time if you happen to be in that first condition with a placebo, or the second. Some people ended up in total getting one dose of DMT. Other people ended up getting two doses of DMT. Then you do all these assessments and questionnaires and clinical interviews. And before even doing any of that, we actually decided on the dose through a whole separate study in people without depression in dose escalation, different doses, to make sure we got the dose that we thought was the most optimal, meaning tolerated well, but still also inducing a proper psychedelic experience, which we wanted to test in this trial. So that was a whole trial before we did this.
So David, then I suppose the question is not only what did the people who were not getting the placebo experience and what were the effects on them, but were the effects on the people who got two doses somehow different?
Yeah, so they were given with 2 weeks between, and that might be a bit short. It could have been that it would have been more beneficial with, I don't know, 6 weeks between. So then a second dose might have added more value. But in this data set, people benefit from one DMT dose, and they benefited more than the other people who got placebo benefited. So that's the main outcome of the trial. And then there didn't seem to be difference between getting one and two doses. So that means that the next trial probably wouldn't be designed with a 2 week after second dose. Could be that people, depending on their clinical response, would be offered another dose later on. But based on this results, you wouldn't design a trial with two doses with 2 weeks. That doesn't seem to add much than the first dose.
And when you use that expression, people benefited, what do you mean by the benefits? And I suppose, what are the implications of whatever benefit you found?
Yeah, so when you do these trials, you have the eyes on what is it that regulators in the end need to sit and evaluate for considering giving approval to a new treatment. And that is sort of gold standard measures of depression. So what you assess is their depression severity. So you define your positive or negative results after whether there is benefits, meaning improvements in these measures of clinical symptoms of depression from before to after, and whether that differs from what happened in the placebo condition. And overall, in order not to sit and throw a lot of numbers, that is obviously in the paper, I would say that overall it was proper positive trial in the sense that it did show the effects that everybody was hoping for, that people did get better in their depression and more than placebo, and also that there were sustained effects after just this 1 or 2 week. It's a rapid onset kind of treatment with all psychedelics, meaning that the effects are immediate, but then also sustained effects as a group level. Of course, there's variation, meaning some people will benefit more than others. And then in the future, we will find out, what do we do with the ones who don't really respond at all? Do you try other psychedelic or completely different treatment? And the ones who really respond well, but only respond for some months, then when do you treat them again? All that is for larger second stage trials.
But that is interesting that there's this sort of intense short-term effect. But from what you're saying, there is a benefit and a sustained effect that's beyond the sort of pharmacological impact of DMT. Is that right?
Totally. That's exactly right. And that's why these drugs are so fascinating. That's why it has exploded in terms of focus and development and funding into developing these drugs into medicine. One thing is that they also exist outside of medicine. They have a real world culture and use and millennia of experience. But this is not trying to hijack it, but we would like this, if it really can help people really struggling with different mental health, to proper test it out and get it embedded into health systems. The reason why they work beyond their pharmacological presence in the body and in the brain, which is really peculiar and deeply exciting. We have for two decades at Imperial really tried to understand by a lot of brain imaging and so on. And other people are also doing a lot of work, even outside of humans in animal models, trying to understand. The current understanding, I guess, is that they quite powerfully open a window of opportunity for the brain to reshape and change a bit. So almost like a clay that becomes more soft and malleable. And then if you combine that with a profound expanded state of consciousness with immersive visual effects, emotional breakthrough type experiences, profound sense of connectedness, oneness, acceptance typically in these experiences, also altered state of time and space and so on. These profound psychological peak experiences, sometimes referred to as mystical type experiences, they can really be quite therapeutic. And if you put that onto something that happens on a brain level, where the brain becomes very, very flexible and have an ability to reshape a bit, then you have something powerful that can have effects beyond just the day where the dog is in the body.
So you mentioned those mystical type experiences. Of the half who tried DMT the first time, or the people overall who used it, are all of them getting that mystical experience?
I don't think any trials will ever succeed in having everybody having a mystical experience. Maybe if you give an extremely high dose, but then you also have people becoming more anxious, you will have more physical side effects, a bit more headache and so on. So you need to use a dose that sits where it's quite light. But whether they get sub-threshold of a mystical type experience, also still therapeutically totally relevant, we can see in the data. So it's not that it's a absolutely hard cutoff when it's mystical and not. There's different degrees of it. But there's a sort of rough definition of how we can assess it by a questionnaire. There are different questionnaires, but one of them is called Mystical Experience Questionnaire. And if you score more than X number or percentage of the total score on that, then we define it. So in this study, defined that way, a bit more than half have had what we would refer to as a mystical type experience. But what we can see in the data is an association, a relationship between that depth of the experience and the clinical benefits, right? And that is basically confirming what we have seen in many other trials with a lot of the other drugs for whatever condition we're almost investigating. So there's this pattern that the experience is associated with the benefits in these trials. Is that causal? Because that's the million-dollar question. Does that mean that the experience is needed? And that you can't say from these kind of trials, because it's an association, a correlation. So could it be that it's just an epiphenomenon, just something that happens on the side of some biological features in the brain, and that you get that experience, but it's actually not the experience itself? So we have actually interrupted the experience with DMT in another study that we published last year, the year before, Leo Roseman published. And there we can see that if you interrupt the experience, because that is kind of a better sort of scientific approach to understand what the experience means. And in that study, the people who we disturbed in the experience, it was just by asking for a rating all the time. And we could see that they benefited less if we interrupted them. And that speaks to, because the biology should be the same. So that's a bit more speaking to that maybe the experience actually really does mean something. But yeah, in this trial that we're talking about here, we saw that same association.
Well, as you say, it's early days and relatively small numbers in this trial. But what do you see as the significance of these results and where it leads in terms of the ongoing research into DMT?
Exactly. And it, in a way, as I mentioned, it's a molecule pretty similar to psilocybin. Here you just have a model where it's a short experience because of the drug itself and the way it's administered. But it basically shows data results similar to what we see with psilocybin. So it adds to a big pool of data. And you could say in Australia, you clearly are not waiting for the trials, which is fantastic. You have just cracked on and allowed early access out in real clinical, as long as that's monitored. Well, that's fantastic. I've been out there several times also to be involved in some training of colleagues out there, which has been great. But yeah, DMT to get a proper approval requires more trials, larger scale trials where you can close more knowledge gaps. Obviously, that's standard for development. But psilocybin this week came out with absolutely landmark results in the latest clinical phase. So basically, the psilocybin really now looks like it's actually quite likely to end up coming out to be licensed for depression, treatment-resistant depression, within a year now, because the phase 3 late phase clinical trial results came out this week. So it's a very exciting week in the sense that they're both this DMT signal, very promising, very supportive of the what we see with psilocybin or similar, and then psilocybin coming with really late stage results that still hold.
Yeah, right. Well, watch this space. Dr. David Erizo, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thanks a lot for having me.
David Erizo is a psychiatrist and neuroscientist at the Imperial College London.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.